You're listening to episode 197 of Mid-America Reformed Seminary's Roundtable Podcast, a broadcast where the faculty of Mid-America discuss theology and cultural issues from a Reformed perspective. I'm Jared Luchibor, Director of Marketing. Thank you for tuning in. I'm here with Dr. Alan Strange, Professor of Apologetics and Church History here at the seminary, returning to lead us through our series on church history, continuing now in the period of the Middle Ages. Dr. Strange, thank you for joining me once again.
It's good to be here and to be addressing history, something we all love.
Yes, absolutely. So to kick off this segment, we're going to talk about monasticism. Now, you talked about this near the end of the Ancient Church podcasts. Remind us of monasticism's origins and development up to the early Middle Ages.
Yeah, let me just say this about the Middle Ages as we go into this. This is that great period of church history that for many Protestants is a vacuum or a curiosity. We can tend to know, I'm going to answer your question, but I want to just say this. We can tend to know something of the ancient church, right? Particularly because Augustine was there. And then we tend to think Middle Ages. Well, yeah, Aquinas. But Aquinas is some centuries hither. We'll talk about him. Mm-hmm. You get into the high middle and the late Middle Ages before the Reformation. But church history is important really in all of its periods, and the Lord is working and having his work. And so we can talk at a later point about why this sometimes certain periods get called dark ages in this. But yeah, this is an important period. The Lord continues by his Spirit to be with his church. The church, because it's not infallible, continues to both err in places and progress as it walks in faithfulness to the revelation of God. But monasticism, just to remind our listeners, we talked in the last segment of the ancient church about the origins of the movement, and we said that some scholars think that it's prompted by late Jewish communal and ascetic ideals, such as those, say, the Essenes that represented the Dead Sea cult and so forth. Others see a kind of Manichaean dualism or Gnosticism in the various forms that inspired extremes of asceticism with Christianity. And those who were looking for biblical origins point to things in Jesus where he talks about being a eunuch for the sake of the mm-hmm. kingdom,
yep.
Or Paul who talks about he wished that in 1 Corinthians 7 those he writes to would be as he is, not married, as he mentions at that point. So there are things in the teachings of Jesus and Paul that speak about what we might call today radical Christianity. In mm-hmm. other words, something that really requires this kind of extraordinary commitment, and that one may forego marriage, one may forego one's own goods and property, one may do all of this to live in community, to withdraw from the world and be dedicated to the Lord. But we also talked about how that a lot of this sort of radical ethos, if you want to call it that, was lived out or expressed in the ancient church. When the church remained before the conversion of Constantine in 312, when the church remained in those first centuries under persecution. Remember, they had 10 waves yeah. of persecution. And so a lot of the ethos that's always there in the church for certain people, I want to be sold out, you know, in the sense of not an ordinary life and ordinary means of grace being used in one's life, but something more committed. During the period of the persecution before the conversion of the emperor, that was often expressed in martyrdom.
Yep.
That was seen as the ultimate expression of that. So what you have particularly after the conversion of the emperor and the acceptance, if you will, of Christianity in the Roman Empire, you have this new emphasis. There had been these forms, whether you're talking about the Desert Fathers, you can think particularly of Anthony of Egypt, who was very much admired by many, certainly admired by Athanasius and many others. You can think of the early development of the so-called Cenobitic, the common life monasticism, over against the earlier anchoritic monasticism. You can think about that monasticism of the East spreading to the West, and Augustine and others have rules that they develop. Caesarius of Arles, Columban, come to develop rules that ultimately are overshadowed by Benedict around 540 with his rule. But the point is monasticism takes on a life of its own and becomes an expression in the church of, you might even say, something like the high road to heaven. Because by the time you get into the Middle Ages, and then you have the development, we'll talk maybe at a later point some more about development of monasticism with the Franciscans and the Dominicans. But by that time, monasticism becomes in the scheme that is developing of how one is saved, how does one get to heaven. Monasticism is seen as kind of the high road to that. Just an example would be the Sermon on the Mount was taken to be, you might say, a true exposition or a spiritual exposition of the law. And so when Jesus came and the Pharisees all imagined that they kept the law, and they would say to Jesus, well, we're no murderers, we're no adulterers. Jesus rather probingly says, well, the seeds of this are lust in the heart or hatred in the heart. The seeds of adultery and murder are inward. And in fact, because you have this, you are not perfect. So in other words, Jesus gives a really searching exposition of the law, which, to speak of the way the reformers do that, as a first use, would convict everybody. I mean, the Sermon on the Mount in the first place shows us nobody can keep this law. And then it shows us, when we speak about a third use, as Calvin and others did, that what you want then as you're converted, as you're following Jesus, is you don't just want the externals of the Pharisees. You want something very internal. Well, what happens, you say, what does that have to do with monasticism? Well, what it has to do with monasticism is the conviction comes that who can really do this? Your average Christian isn't going to do this. And even most of your parish priests aren't going to do this. And the parish priests come to be called the secular clergy, the clergy that are in the world. Whereas these folks, these monastics, come to be called regular clergy, those who live according to the rule, regula, and are in these kinds of communities. And it's really these people who can only live in this way. I mean, Paul says, for example, pray without ceasing. And they would say, well, how can you do that? Well, you have to structure the whole day according to prayers. And you need to be in this all the time, of course. If we really understand that, they would also do manual labor and do other things. Nobody can actually be in conscious prayer all the time. So Paul doesn't obviously mean that. And there's also, and we even have a great hymn that speaks about it, prayer being really a whole attitude. And but what you get here is this notion in the Middle Ages, and we're going to see this more as we talk about this as we go along. What you're going to witness in the Middle Ages is the clericalization of the church.
Right.
And that will include sort of the first order, the regular clergy, the monks and nuns, the second order, the secular clergy, the parish priests, and all the hierarchy of the church. They're going to become, in the eyes of Rome, the church. They will be really the church, and they will be living out the Christian life properly. Most Christians who just are having, you know, are laboring in the fields, or what, maybe they're noblemen even, and they're having families and they're having children. These are the people that populate the church. You can't have the church without these people, but they're not the people who the church understands to be really living the Christian life.
Right.
Only the clergy does. So that's the direction that this is going to move in.
Now, as Protestants, we tend not to favor monasticism. Can you explain why?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of what I just said gets at that, doesn't it? Because, obviously, no small part of the Reformation, we don't want to talk too much about that because there's a lot more to say as we move towards it and get there. But no small part of the Reformation is the recovery, if you will, of the proper role of everyone in the church. The laity that had been marginalized because the church had been clericalized, recover. And all Christians understand that we're to live in accordance with the Sermon on the Mount, which only can be done by the grace of God. It can be done by none of us perfectly. None of us can keep the law. We must trust Jesus, who alone kept it. But he, having kept it for us, does enable us by his Spirit to make a small beginning of walking in all the ways that he has set forth, maybe the smallest of beginnings, right? We understand that. But Protestants do not believe that in order to really serve the Lord, you need to withdraw from the world for the sake of the world. I should say that the monastics did have this ideal of we're withdrawing from the world for the sake of the world. What mm-hmm. we're doing is for the good of everybody.
If you were to say or make comments on whether any, I mean, you kind of touched on a little bit of them, maybe expand on some of them, but good things that have come out of monasticism, what would you say?
Well, providentially, no question did the Lord, there's no question that the Lord used monasticism because the communities formed by the monastics became often, particularly now in the Middle Ages, and with the, something we'll talk about in just a bit here, the, not in this podcast, but in a future podcast, the barbarian invasions and the conversion of the barbarian tribes. During this time, that is when the old Roman Empire was being overrun, and what we would call Europe was in the process of formation, what we now know as Europe, as all the tribes come in and conversion happens. It was in the monasteries, oftentimes, that there was the preservation of the scriptures. That is to say, these were scriptorums where they copied the scriptures, the manuscripts.
Yep.
So they preserved that. They were preserves of learning, where they kept the languages alive to the degree that they were. They were preserves of piety. There was a great deal of piety in this. And you may know, for example, Thomas Cahill famously talks about this when he says, when he wrote about how the Irish saved civilization. And what the book is really about is how the monasteries mm-hmm. in Ireland preserved the Western heritage, both the Latin heritage over against all the barbarian invasions and tribes, but the biblical heritage and the Christian heritage was often preserved during these times.
So as we progress through this segment of church history, you know, we're going to be touching on various church councils, the fall of the Roman Empire, and even the rise of Islam. Throughout all of this and throughout the Middle Ages, where is monasticism going to go?
Well, we could talk about five epochs in monastic history. There's, first of all, the appearance of the hermit and the Eremite, that is the desert father. So that's kind of the first part, say, in the 4th century. And then there's Benedict of Nursia and his rule in the 6th century. There's Cluny and those associated with it, and that's going to involve a lot of reform within the church. Actually, a lot of reform that's needed in certain respects, certainly morally and organizationally, is going to come out of the monasteries in the 10th and 11th centuries. And then you're going to have the rise and the spread of the mendicants, the so-called beggar orders. And these are folks who don't just remain in the monastery and do their labor and produce things that they might sell, like some monasteries sold superb brandy. Couldn't be beat. Still do. But you have the Franciscans and the Dominicans who rise in the 12th and 13th centuries, and they go out of the monasteries, and they actually preach the gospel in many places, and in the language of the people, which they don't hear in church because everything's in Latin, and people don't really understand it. We're going to talk more about that. And then you have the Jesuit order that really defends
Rome and is the opponent of the Reformation. They rise in the 16th century. So that's something of where things are going to go in terms of monastic history.
Next time, Dr. Strange examines the Second and Third Council of Constantinople and the Second Council of Nicaea. Tune in next time to hear about the important theological issues that were at stake in this period of church history. If you enjoyed today's episode, consider subscribing and sharing it with friends or family. Your support helps us bring more engaging content to your ears and helps us foster not just a community of lifelong learners, but thoughtful practitioners. I'm Jared Luchibor. Thank you for listening. We'll see you in the next episode.